In this final lecture of Unit 5, Component 2, we will talk about means of putting evidence into practice. Putting evidence into practice basically means specifying a recommendation. This figure from the GIAT textbook goes through the steps we take to specify a recommendation that allows us to put evidence into practice. First, we look at our options. If we are talking about tests or treatments, we see what tests or treatments we want to use for a given symptom or disease, and we look at the outcomes, how efficacious a test or treatment is. So the first step is to specify the options and outcomes, and that gives us a framework for our decision. We then use evidence to determine the link between the options and outcomes in all relevant patient subgroups. In essence, we go gather the evidence. We also need to incorporate values so that we can decide on the optimal course of action. This step is recognition by the evidence-based medicine community that there are some things that matter besides evidence, in particular, patient preferences and values. This is when we employ something either like a decision analysis or practice guideline. We may need to take the generic decision analysis or practice guideline and then modify it based on local circumstances. We may then develop the local guideline that is derived from a more general guideline. In this lecture, we will discuss in detail practice guidelines and decision analysis. What is a clinical practice guideline? It is basically a series of steps, sometimes called an algorithm, that walk us through the provision of clinical care, either the workup to reach a diagnosis or the steps of the treatment. Clinical practice guidelines can be provided in a number of ways. Sometimes they can be provided in a textual format or in tables that list what should be done in certain conditions. Oftentimes they will be presented as an algorithm. Algorithms have different types of steps. There are action steps, where we perform a specific action. There are conditional steps, where we carry out an action based on some criterion. There are branch steps, where flow may be directed to one or more other steps. Finally, there is synchronization, where we come back from the branch steps to a single point. This slide shows a very simple practice guideline that might be used for something like deciding whether someone should get a flu shot. The recommendations on who should get a flu shot vary, but in this guideline, we will see who they are recommended for. Our first step in the guideline is to collect some data. We branch because we need to get two pieces of data. We need to get the occupation of the individual and their age. We synchronize back until we get both of those pieces of data. We then reach conditional step 1, where we ask if the age is less than 12. According to this guideline, we should immunize everyone who is under the age of 12, and we should use the pediatric dosage that is modified for their weight and size. If they are older than 12, we then ask if they are either a healthcare worker or older than age 65. If they are, we give the adult dosage. We go to that action step. Otherwise, which probably does not reflect current practice, we do not. This is a sample algorithm to show you the different kinds of steps that you might see in a clinical practice guideline. How do we appraise a clinical practice guideline? In some ways, it is easier than appraising something like a randomized control trial because there are fewer questions to ask. However, there are many more steps within a clinical practice guideline that need to be appraised as opposed to just the major question that you look at in a randomized control trial. If we do retrieve a clinical practice guideline and we are thinking about putting it into practice, what questions do we ask? Essentially, there are three. The first question we ask is, did the developers carry out a comprehensive, reproducible literature search within the last 12 months? In other words, are they up to date on their topic? If they are looking at diagnosis of a certain type of cancer or treatment of diabetes, are they current on the latest evidence? Have they reviewed the literature comprehensively? The second question is whether each of the recommendations are tagged by the level of evidence upon which they are based and linked to a specific citation. If the practice guideline makes a recommendation for a test or a treatment, what is the level of evidence to support that recommendation, and what is the citation? What is the study, the article that determines that evidence? We then have to look at applicability. Is the guideline applicable in a particular clinical setting? This brings up some practical questions. For example, is there a high enough burden of illness to warrant use of the guideline in this particular setting? If the disease occurs rarely, then we probably do not want to go to the trouble of changing workflow and other kinds of actions to implement the guideline. Is there adequate belief among the users of the guideline concerning the value of the interventions and their consequences? Have we convinced those who are going to implement the guideline that it is worth doing so? And might the cost and barriers be too high for the community? If there is a certain type of diagnostic test or treatment that is not readily available, might the barriers be too high for implementation, making use of the guideline somewhat moot? The best guidelines are those that associate evidence with each step along the way. One of the resources that does this best is the ACP Peer resource. In PEER, which actually presents most of its guidelines as lists, there is a rating of evidence, A being the best, meaning it typically comes from a randomized control trial or a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. B, coming from good quality other evidence, like a good observational study. And C, being some evidence but relatively weak evidence. Shown on the slide is a part of the recommendation from PEER for the treatment of diabetes. A variety of treatment steps are presented to the reader of the guideline, and the evidence associated with each recommendation is presented in this A, B, or C classification. One of the big questions with practice guidelines is whether it is more effective to use them in paper or electronic form. The problem with paper guidelines is illustrated in this slide, showing the number of guidelines these particular practitioners had received. Hibble collected all the guidelines that he and his practice mates had been sent in the mail over a one-year period. They had found that 855 guidelines had been disseminated to one or more practices within this area of England. The pile was 68 centimeters high and weighed 28 kilograms. Clearly, it is a challenge to use any particular guideline when they are in a pile like this one. It may be better to electronically disseminate guidelines, especially if you can codify recommendations in the electronic health record so that the recommendations come up automatically. Research has shown that physicians often do not adhere to guidelines. Cabana found that guidelines were not used by physicians for a variety of reasons. They were either unaware of them, they disagreed with them, or they did not want to change their existing practice. More recently, in some highly regarded practices in the United Kingdom, it was found that physicians and nurses rarely accessed or used research evidence. Instead, they used what the authors described as mind lines that basically represented their rationale, which it sometimes was at odds with research evidence. More recently, Lynn found that there was a substantial lack of adherence to a guideline recommendation on the use of stress testing before percutaneous coronary intervention. That is, according to the best evidence and the guidelines that incorporate this evidence, a patient should not have percutaneous coronary interventions, such as coronary angioplasty or stent placement, unless they have symptoms documented by stress testing. Yet many cardiologists skip the step of stress testing and move straight to the percutaneous coronary intervention. In an editorial, Diamond was concerned about this, and he attributes the situation to financial incentives for such intervention, and advocates what he calls evidence-based reimbursement. Practice guidelines certainly have limitations. One challenge for guidelines is that they are difficult to apply in complex patients. For example, A study by Boyd and colleagues looked at 15 common diseases, and they took the best-known guidelines for those diseases and assessed them for use in elderly patients who had many comorbid or coexisting conditions. They reached the conclusion that following the guidelines to the letter would have undesirable effects because of the presence of these other conditions. In fact, if these guidelines were tied into pay-for-performance schemes, there may be some negative implications in that physicians who would adhere to the letter of the guidelines may actually not be providing the highest quality of care. Guidelines can be difficult to implement in electronic health records. In particular, it is challenging to take the logic that is in guidelines and integrate it into the workflow. Some of the logic in guidelines is somewhat vague and may not fit into easy rules that can be implemented in a decision support system. This paper by Mavila gives a number of examples of that. Another problem with guidelines is the influence of the pharmaceutical industry, in that many individuals who do this kind of work are also funded in part by the industry. About 87% of authors, at least in the survey that was done for this paper, have ties to industry. About 58% of them received financial support for their research, and some of those individuals also serve as employees or consultants to pharmaceutical companies, raising questions of objectivity. What is the future of guidelines? Many healthcare systems are convinced of their value. They are convinced that they standardize and improve care, and perhaps lower costs. The use of guidelines will likely increase with both the proliferation of electronic health records as well as the implementation of quality measures and pay for performance. Guidelines are easily accessible. If you are interested in guidelines, the National Guidelines Clearinghouse at www.guideline.gov has over 1,000 in its database, most of which can be downloaded. Let's make a few comments about decision analysis. Decision analysis applies a formal structure that allows the integration of evidence about both beneficial and harmful effects of treatment options with associated data use and preferences. Decision analysis enables us to explicitly lay out the factors that go into decision-making and assign numerical values and calculate a value and quantitative measure to guide decision-making. Decision analysis can be applied to the care of a single patient, but more commonly in recent years, decision analysis has been used to inform decisions about policy. Here is an example of a simple decision analysis that revolves around the decision to use anticoagulation in a patient with atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation is where the upper chamber of the heart fibrillates, and blood can accumulate because it is not properly pumped out of the atrium. This can form clots, and if the individual then goes back into a normal rhythm, the clot can be pushed forward out of the heart, and pieces of it can potentially go up into the cerebral circulation and cause a stroke. There are basically three options for a patient with atrial fibrillation in whom we want to prevent stroke. We can do nothing. Give no prophylaxis. We can use aspirin, which is a mild blood thinner, or warfarin, also known as Coumadin, which is a more potent blood thinner. For each of these options, we have four possibilities. This patient can either have a stroke or not have a redo. The patient can either have a stroke or not have a stroke, and any one of these options will potentially lead to adverse bleeding. Because we have two possible options, we have four permutations: no stroke with no bleed, a stroke with no bleed, no stroke with bleeding, and a stroke with bleeding. Obviously, the best thing for the patient would be to have neither a stroke nor bleeding. We know from the medical literature that warfarin is more effective at preventing stroke, but it also has a higher rate of bleeding. We would actually apply numbers into these different pathways through the decision analysis to make our decision. The circles are the chance nodes, because with each of these treatments, there is a chance of any of those four outcomes. The square is the decision node for the decision that we are trying to make. How do we actually use a decision analysis? Essentially, we have to put numerical values on the pathways through the decision tree. Some of those pathways involve incorporating utility values that the patient has. Patients may express preferences for adverse outcomes. They may be more tolerable of stroke or of bleeding. Sometimes, in the cases of surgery patients, they may be more willing to tolerate the risk up front of surgery as opposed to the longer-term consequence of not doing surgery and having a longer-term worse outcome. So we plug evidence values and utility values into the tree. Then, we do a process called folding the tree back, where we basically determine the optimal pathway through the tree. What are the limitations of decision analysis? Decision analysis may present an idealized situation that may not completely apply to a patient, although it does give a framework for making a decision or deviating from a standardized approach. The real challenge with decision analysis, particularly when we apply it to individual patients, is that it is time-consuming and very dependent on trying to quantify things that may not be quantifiable, such as how much risk to assign to one outcome versus another. Decision analyses have not had a major impact when used on the individual level, though for policy decisions, they actually have been quite valuable.